So welcome to the podcast. Today we're joined by Bobos. I'm guessing that's the what you guys go by.
Just Bobo's Void.
Yeah.
Bobo's Void? Okay.
Yeah. Recently it's Mango's Void, who's also here with us.
Yeah, she's our dog.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Very cute. As I said, really enjoy your content. Definitely recommend checking your channel out, and I'll put it in the description. But if you guys maybe want to elaborate on what you do and your work and everything.
Yeah. Do you want me to start? Do you want
to go? Sure.
Yeah. So Bobo's Void is essentially just a philosophy podcast where we talk about anything ranging from relationships, love, to suicide, freedom, politics, all the good stuff. And yeah, we're just here to unpack the human condition and try to figure out why we are the way we are as a species.
Yeah, unpacking the human condition for people who don't have the time to.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, what art is supposed to be about.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I guess I want to ask first of all, because it seems very kind of off the cuff when you guys do have your discussions. Like, is there a lot of thought, like, beforehand in how you're going to articulate your ideas? Do they, like, is it just very spontaneous? Does it come from, is it a little bit of both?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. We're always reading, watching documentaries, asking people questions. We're like those annoying people at dinner parties that's like, why are you alive, or like, why did you get divorced? So we're always just sort of, yeah, like on the job kind of. So maybe the way topics come up is like, maybe we'll meet an Uber driver and they'll say something really interesting about maybe, say, George Bush, or I don't know, Donald Trump, and we'll just, that'll spark a conversation, and then we'll just discuss it on the podcast, and then it just sort of goes from there.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times we end up choosing topics by kind of seeing what is bothering people, or the problems that people are most concerned by, and trying to just get to the root of it, you know, trying to see like what kind of keeps people up at night, or what their biggest complaints are about being alive, and just trying to figure out why people are miserable, or what they're struggling with. I think we actually argue a lot and debate a lot about very, very human things. And a lot of our arguments will turn into episodes. So we'll just be having an argument and we'll realize like, oh, we're having an argument about free will, actually. And we thought we were having an argument about whether or not people can improve their lives. And when you kind of dig under the surface of that argument, you'll find that, oh, it's actually a very philosophical argument. So I think argument, but in a productive sense, is where we get a lot of our topics from.
Yeah, I think that's what I appreciate about your work is a lot of, especially content online, it's very just like, it's one person talking, like including mine. Usually there isn't really like a discourse. And it's hard to, I think, achieve that discourse online because it is a lot of people want to argue to kind of like prove their position first and foremost. And yeah, it's rare to see discussions where people want to argue to kind of arrive at maybe a more like precise truth, or like something more like dialectical. And I really see that. But I guess regarding the topic today, I'm kind of curious, how would you define self-love? Because, you know, as you said, a lot of the topics you discuss are kind of what keeps people up at night, what's kind of relevant to the average person, but maybe they don't have a lot of time to think about these things. And, you know, I think it's like it's cliche advice, kind of like, oh, you just have to love yourself, or sometimes like, oh, don't jump into a relationship until you like feel good about yourself. But there isn't, there's a lot of like different forms of advice, and sometimes they're contradictory. But I think before we get into that, just like, how would you guys define self-love?
Do you want to go first?
Yeah, I think there's almost two divergent paths in what people mean when they say self-love. The first one, something I think is very positive, which is, I think, a reaction to how overexploited and emotionally exhausted people are these days, and how you can go weeks without maybe doing like one kind act to yourself. And that is a very pure positive cultural development, I think. So that would be the positive side of self-love. And then I think the kind of nefarious side of that word, or the way that word has been used, is sort of a kind of outgrowth of the cult of the self, and the way that corporations have made us internalize the failures that are actually very, very systemic, as things that we should personally be doing to improve ourselves. So self-love is a way of almost, and by the way, the negative side of self-love, not the positive side, but the negative side, is a way of almost gaslighting the public into basically taking accountability for things that aren't their fault. And if you're exhausted after working a 60-hour, you know, a week, it's actually just, you know, putting cucumbers over your eyes and taking more naps that's going to fix that, as opposed to, like, you know, having more worker protections or whatever. Or if you're failing romantically because we've fundamentally, like, atomized everyone through dating apps or whatever, it's actually that you need to love yourself more. So I think what often happens when terms get so big is the positive and negative interpretations of them became very, very difficult to differentiate, because I think on one hand, self-love is really positive and the world needs a lot more of it. And people are very right to have this very reactionary response to being overexploited and not feeling like they have any time for themselves. And then on the other hand, there is a very systemic effort to force people to individualize the failings of the entire system as personal failings, you know? So I think it's almost two definitions. That may have been a very long answer. What do you think?
Yeah. I like that. I like that your definition is very political. I like bell hooks's definition of love. She's my Lord and Savior. And, her definition of love, which I think she may have borrowed from M. Scott Peck, is that love is extending yourself for someone else's or your own spiritual growth. And so I think self-love is extending yourself for your own spiritual growth. Yeah, I think self-love is, yeah, it's just that. It's extending yourself for your own spiritual growth, your own spiritual, mental, and physical well-being.
How would you define, like, spiritual growth?
I know, yeah, it's an interesting question, because I know the word spiritual is so loaded. but the way I would define spiritual growth is really just getting to know yourself, like, sort of getting to... how do I put it? Like, getting to know yourself outside of the societal constructs that are thrown onto us. So, like, we're all thrown into the world and we're thrown into all these different boxes. Like, you're a woman, you're South African, you're Christian, you're whatever the case is. And I think getting to know yourself is sort of like seeing yourself without all of those constructs, and how you sort of like make up, or how you coexist with, like, the entire, with, like, everyone else, like, where you fit in with the entire ecosystem of humanity and the planet at large. If that makes sense. I don't know.
I think it's like an unearthing of the self, a discovery of the self.
Yeah.
A resistance to the conditioning and a tapping into who you really are.
Yeah. Like, just an emptying of your mind.
It is kind of making me think, as maybe like a counterpoint. I do agree, like self-knowledge is definitely an aspect of self-love. But I'm thinking of somebody who took that kind of to an extreme. A lot of people would consider this person as kind of taking that quest for self-knowledge to, like, almost a destructive level, but Friedrich Nietzsche, like, he went into the mountains and he kind of, you know, he became kind of insane. And it's interesting, because maybe that is kind of self-love in a way, because he just completely stripped himself of any sort of, you know, as much as he could of any sort of values from the outside world. And, you know, he was just kind of out in nature. And but at the same time, I don't think anybody would see an image of Nietzsche as like a as a promoter of self-love necessarily, because he's such a, I think he was so focused on like power. But then it is making me think that in a way that is the link, that, that there is like self-knowledge, but then there's also power to kind of put that into, to practice. What do you think of that?
I think that back to that negative definition of self-love, there are a lot of elements of idolatry in that. Almost people view it as making yourself your own god, almost a worship of the self. I believe kind of the twin sister of self-love, almost like the self-care movement, can turn into that a lot. I think we live in a very secular society. And not to make any statement on whether that's good or bad, but that does lead a big, it leaves a very big hole for a new god to worship. And a lot of people have filled that hole that the death of God left kind of in the 20th century, with themselves, you know, the postmodern response to like previous forms of religious faith has quite honestly been replaced by the self. And it's not a coincidence to me that a lot of these phrases start with the word self. But I guess back to that negative definition of it, it seems a bit like a distraction, because a lot of the things that are good for the self are more communal acts, are things that have to do about improving your community, so therefore you can improve your mental health or your standing in the world. And and I think what the positive version of self-love is becoming someone who can actually be of better use to others, kind of putting on your safety vest before putting on someone else's. That would be the positive version of that. But I definitely think we're living in an age where that positive message has almost become a front for a far more nefarious thing, which is a worship of the self, which makes a lot of sense, because there was a huge hole left kind of at the end of modernism when we kind of killed God, or we killed modernist ideas. It could be Marxism, capitalism, you know, all these things. And we had a hole left that postmodernism left. And we filled that with the self. We filled that with endless self-improvement. Here's how to maximize the self. You know, here's how to optimize the self. And what's funny is that's now leading to self-destruction, which is, kind of the inevitable consequence of destroying community. But yeah, I definitely don't want to be too negative on this idea of self-love. I definitely just think it is important to almost differentiate the two. You know,
would you agree with the? I like that there's like a balancing of positive and negative between the two of you. It's I think it's useful for the discussion. Would you agree that there is sort of like a like communal aspect to self-love, and maybe that's where like if that's not addressed, it's like kind of a balancing act where like. You do want that agency and knowing yourself, but then it is like when I think of people that really love themselves, they are kind of like a somewhat sacrificial, or they're like, you know, they don't think about other people's opinion too much. And they're usually very like giving. Like, I think that's a very like honest, I guess I'm like, it's making me think of like, Tilling came up with like the idea that there was kind of phases of identity formation throughout history. And like, I guess like when there was like, when it was less secular, there was the idea of like sincerity, where our identities were kind of already preformed when we were born. And like you would be born a Christian, you would be born into like a specific family role that you would play out. Like if you're, you know, family owned a farm, you would just like work on the farm. It was very like unquestioned. And then kind of with the death of God, I'm not sure if Tilling specifically makes this a like link, but in a more secular age, it became the age, instead of sincerity, there was authenticity. So the idea of identity became like less preformed. It's like that sort of like existence precedes essence, where you're born and then you have to like kind of discover yourself or unlock yourself. And that was very dominant, especially I think in like the 20th century. and nowadays too. And then there's these philosophers, Muller and Ambrosio, I believe, they came up with the identity formation that we're in now, which is called prophylicity. And I hadn't thought about it until now, but it kind of, it puts the communal and agentic components of what we're talking about together, where people, like, I think people are a bit more cynical of the idea that you like unlock your authentic self, or there's like some sort of inner self that like you just have to find, because as you said, like that is kind of what the self-improvement community kind of preys on, is like you just have to work hard enough, or like you just really have to, it's kind of a sort of narcissism. But prophylicity is people design their profiles, you know, online and in real life. And it's a lot of it is, it is in reference to how other people view them and stuff like that, but it's very kind of loose and flexible. So it, and in doing that, there is sort of this kind of playful act of identity formation where they're kind of discovering themselves through other people. And I'm not sure if I'm like explaining it super well, but I'm wondering if you think that that's a, and that in itself can have nefarious consequences, because people can over-identify with their profile and become obsessed, and like, you know, it could lead to narcissism also. But yeah, I'm wondering what you think of that.
Yeah, I think what you're describing is actually Ubuntu, which is basically just the idea that if I translated directly from my language, which is Tswana, it's the idea that a person is a person because of people. And so with that in mind, I don't think there is such a thing as self-love without other people, without collectivism, without community. I think oftentimes when we talk about self-love, especially in the context of like romantic love, there's this idea that you can't love someone else until you love yourself, which is an idea I've always disagreed with, because I think you can actually only learn to love yourself through other people's love. So in that way, I think self-love and communal love, or just love, they just work symbiotically, and they're actually kind of the same thing, because you can't love yourself without loving other people, and you can't love other people without loving yourself. And I also think that love is inherently egalitarian, which doesn't mean inherently communist, but I do think love is inherently like an egalitarian construct, which means that in order to love yourself, you'd have to love other people. And in order to love other people, you would have to feel that you are sort of on the same, not the same, but you are on the same pedestal, and not that one is on a higher pedestal than the other. That's where I'm at with that.
Just like building off that idea too, I think that a lot of our modern culture is based in sort of this view of yourself and your potential and what is valuable about you, almost as this mine of gems that need to be unearthed. I have a scarce amount of gems inside of me, and my life needs to be dedicated to excavating that. A lot of people's views around creativity or productivity are clearly informed by that, even the way they speak, you know, about themselves, where it's like, oh, I've already done all my best ideas, or I've already, they view themselves as this mine of gold that is scarce. It's a scarce worldview. And then there's almost a way of viewing yourself as just sort of a wind chime that when the wind blows, or when there is the proper resources around you, you can do great things. So I think self-love and self-improvement and the gym bros that are trying to tell you to rise and grind every 5 seconds, they're clearly operating from this excavation model of self-improvement, as opposed to self-improvement comes when I surround myself by the right people and I'm in the right environment and I'm able to basically kind of be played like an instrument, you know? And I think I personally have spent a lot of my life viewing creativity, or just viewing positive things that could come from me, more through this excavation model. I viewed myself as a mine and I had this limited resource, and that didn't lead me to becoming the best version of myself. The thing that led me to self-improvement or self-love or self-care was actually surrounding myself with people that brought the best out of me. And I think a lot of that is intentional. I think a lot of the messaging is to intentionally kind of condition you to believe in scarcity almost, you know, to view self-improvement and self-love as something that you do alone in a room, and you should go into a cave and think. And I've personally never had my best ideas or even just had the most fun doing that. I've always had my best ideas or improved or even loved myself the most when I've created the proper environment, you know? And I think there is a very intentional, almost propaganda around viewing self-love about the optimization of self as opposed to putting yourself in an environment where you can thrive, because that would challenge too much corporate power.
Yeah.
That's a separate issue. But yeah, I definitely think that it's very, very intentional. And this mode of production that we're doing under neoliberal capitalism almost requires these worldviews. If people were to view self-optimization through the lens of community, people would start asking a lot of questions about the way that we've set up society, you know?
What do you think is self-love?
I think in like a practical sense, I do agree with bell hooks' version. And I do also kind of struggle with the, what does the spiritual aspect mean? But I almost feel it's kind of like a subjective kind of feeling. It's not really like a, maybe it's just fundamentally difficult to articulate. The most useful thing I can think of is, and this is after having some sort of self-insight and awareness of where you stand and who you are, is I think of it in terms of like when you have a best friend or a good partner and like they become your best friend or like your partner, ideally because you can trust them. And it's like you make plans and they show up to the plans. You communicate with them about something that maybe you don't like them doing, and you know, they stop or they're at least willing to like listen, and you guys come to like a better solution. Is that idea of turning that to yourself, that sort of trust, where if you make promises to yourself, you have to hold yourself to those promises, and then you build this trust after a while in the same way that you would build in another relationship, and you actually start to like trust yourself and love yourself. Because it's just like a nice kind of feedback loop. And at least like holding myself to that has kind of, allowed me to, I think like myself more, because I think it also incorporates the, if a friend messed up and didn't, you know, like every once in a while they do something that, you know, they weren't supposed to do or something like that. If they're your friend, you wouldn't just like cut them off, or you wouldn't like punish them or something. But when we mess up and we do things sometimes like, you know, like dieting or something, like we slip up or something, we're so like, we want to like punish ourselves. We're so mean to ourselves, and then we'll break further like, promises that we made. But I'm like, if you see yourself as that friend, you would actually be like compassionate and you'd go like, I'm human. Like I make mistakes. And the same way you'd think the friend is human and like makes mistakes, and, and you'd take a deep breath, you go, it's okay. And then you would just try to like keep those promises and try to build that trust with yourself. So I don't think it's definitely not a very like philosophical, approach, but it's helped me a lot. Yeah.
Do you love yourself? Question for both of you.
I think so. It's definitely not like a consistent, you know, definitely there's rough days. And I think naturally people that gravitate towards social media and want like influence, there is a validation, like a desire for external validation, at least initially. And, the fact that that is a part of my job, I have to be kind of cognizant of that. But I think overall, because I try to stay like grounded and maintain friendships with people like that are just in my life and they just like hanging out with me for me and not like, you know, other reasons. I think that that kind of helps me kind of also feel grounded and kind of love myself. And, you know, I think it goes back to that, you know, having people like being engaged with other people and on a sort of equal footing. So.
Yeah, I think that it's really hard to think about self-love without thinking about the idea of shame. You know, if I think shame is kind of the antithesis of self-love.
Ooh.
And I've been grappling a lot with the idea of shame because as someone who almost grew up with this like Abrahamic worldview, because I grew up Christian and you internalize all those morals, you're almost taught that shame is a good thing, which is how I think we probably created a society where so few people love themselves, because we're almost taught that there's a merit in shame. Shame is almost the catalyst of self-improvement. Yeah. How could you ever become someone worth loving if you love yourself all the time? And I think something I struggle with is the utility of shame, because it is almost impossible for me to fully love myself if I think that shame can lead to positive consequences, you know?
Right.
Is it good to feel comfortable in your skin or at your current position in life or the extent to which you're being good to your friends or your family? Is it good to just be fully content with that constantly? Or is it actually positive that we have this shame because it forces us to strive to be better?
Yeah.
And I think that is also an interesting conversation that sort of leads to the pros and cons of modernist ideas like Christianity versus like postmodernist ideas that like there is no objective truth, because from the postmodernist lens, it's almost like, okay, God is dead. No one can tell you anything you're doing is wrong. Love yourself. Everything will be great. Like you're fine as you are. And I think that can be very positive. And then also the modernist message of almost as if no one is really that great. Improving yourself is good. You should always be trying to analyze and scrutinize yourself so that you can better show up for other people. I also think that has some positive consequences too, you know? So I personally grapple a lot with the utility of shame and how much is it appropriate to love yourself? Because I think we all know people who probably love themselves a little too much. And that goes back to that cult of the self thing, where it's, is a person taking selfies every 5 seconds? Is that healthy or is that idolatry? Do you view yourself like as a god at that point? And I think as a lot of people alive right now, we struggle with just being reactionary generally.
Yeah.
So I think that the right answer would probably be somewhere in the middle of those two things, somewhere in the middle between seeing the utility and shame and radical self-love, but it is very hard to be balanced in anything these days. So I think I struggle to find the balance between those two.
Yeah, between how much love is too much love.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there such a thing as too much love, or is too much love an oxymoron? Like, if you're at the point where you feel you love yourself too much, are you now describing narcissism? Or actually even just a disconnection from yourself? You know, I don't know. What do you guys think?
What are your thoughts?
Is there such a thing as too much love?
Yeah, because narcissism, I like to always see it as a kind of a cult of oneself. Like a lot of them are, especially because there's the two types. There's the vulnerable and the grandiose narcissists. The grandiose narcissists are, they're, you know, that is, it is hard to get in that mind state, but they're very genuinely, they think that they are the best and the whole world should love them. And then the vulnerable narcissists, they're the ones that they feel like they should be, or like they could be the best, but like, but there's a lot of shame. They're very like unhappy. Generally those two. So I'm trying to incorporate both of those together. I think that it's the fact that there's a fragility to where that love is coming from, because it's from external sources. I mean, a narcissist at the end of the day, they're not, they're extremely motivated people because they want, like they need that validation from other people. They need to constantly prove themselves through other people. It's that idea of proving yourself, like proving you're perfect. And, you know, I think self-love would require not just grappling with, but like accepting your own flaws, you know, laughing at yourself, like, you know, being able to like those, there's something there. There's that humility, and self-compassion that I think is just, it's really missing in narcissism in general. And I do think that it becomes kind of like, like a cult of the self, where it's, these people don't really even have agency in what they want to do, because they feel like they constantly have to serve themselves. They have to constantly like find like new followers to worship them. And there's that pressure. And I think going back to what you're saying about the mechanism of shame, I actually do think that that might be where self-love kind of, if it's based off of fear rather than love, that's the dichotomy there that can tell us when it becomes like reckless. Like if you're doing things genuinely out of love, you don't actually care about the outcome. Like you're doing it because there's something autotelic. There's something like just nice about it. Like it just going back to kind of make like keeping promises to yourself. Whereas out of fear, you're like kind of like, if this doesn't go well, then I have to do this or that. And there's like kind of this sort of desperation. And there's that basically that attempt to escape shame. That would be my take on it.
Yeah, it's interesting that we view like narcissism as too much love, because I actually think it's a lack of love for yourself and a compensating for that lack of love. I actually think it's a deep self-loathing and an inner sense of emptiness that causes that. And I also think another thing that causes that is, I don't know if you guys have ever read the book Ways of Seeing by John Berger. There's a really interesting chapter in there. About women and the way that we see ourselves. And just he talks a lot about this idea that as a woman, you're constantly seeing yourself through the eyes of men, because you're taught that your value or your identity is about being seen and loved by men. And I think a lot of people generally are conditioned to view themselves through the eyes of other people, which actually makes love impossible, both for yourself and for other people. Because I think love requires honesty. Like one of the fundamental foundations of love, whether it be love for others or love for yourself, is honesty. And I think honesty or like truth about the self is never nice. It's never like pleasant entirely. And I think, yeah, the truth is that we're all trash. We're all trash in our own unique and different ways. And I think there's a lot of beauty in that. And I think until you can fully see the trash in you and be trash with your full chest and be able to laugh at your trashness and accept the ways that you are trash, I actually think love becomes impossible, both love for yourself and love for others. Because even when people are trash, when someone else is trash, you'll always take that personally, or you'll always be triggered by that trashness because you can't accept your own inner trashness. Self-love comes first from an acceptance that I am trash because I'm human, and to be human is to be trash. It's also to be like beautiful and interesting and a bunch of other things, but also trash. And I think, yeah, until we can like really fully accept that without shame, I don't think love is possible at all.
Yeah, that's very, very true. I think that something I can't kind of help think about a lot is something that like Frantz Fanon kind of said in The Wretched of the Earth, when he was laying out kind of what colonialism is as a system, which is the focus on the self. Colonialism is individualism. Yeah. And that's why so many attempts to quote unquote decolonize the way we think fail, because we're trying to do it through the self.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to become a politician that creates my followers, and then we're going to create this revolution. Well, you cannot create a revolution against individualism through the individual, because the system is individualism.
Yeah.
And I think a big part of the way that we've structured the world now kind of very closely aligns with kind of DSM style definitions of clinical narcissism and psychopathy.
Yeah.
And along with being self-aggrandizing and, you know, delusions of grandeur, a big part of the definition of like psychopathy and clinical narcissism is a lack of remorse.
Oh,
so when I get very worried about the utility of shame, and almost when I get worried about potentially loving myself too much, what I'm really getting worried about is not having remorse, because I really fear the way in which our society almost encourages not having remorse. Because that is almost the thing that is scariest about narcissism, almost that energy of like, do you get the bag, love you, when that is almost advocating for a lack of remorse, like, do whatever is best for yourself at the expense of others, because because the objective should be to love yourself. And when I hear people get caught up in that too much, I get very hesitant. Not because I think there's anything wrong with self-love, because I'm triggered by how similar it is to that definition of psychopathy, of not having remorse when you hurt others at the expense. When you improve yourself at the expense of others, because we're fundamentally Machiavellian for ourselves. It's by any means necessary. Love yourself by any means.
Well, I have a question, and also maybe a statement, which is, is love possible under capitalism? Any form of love? Because capitalism is an economic system rooted in scarcity. So inherently, in order to gain anything for yourself, or for anyone else, in order to gain, you have to take at the expense of someone else. If this is the premise of what society is, if this is our religion, and I would argue that this is our religion, it's capitalism, is love possible?
I'm going to let you take this one.
Oh my God. I have so many. There were so many things that were just touched upon. I've been reading, and I think it links to Fanon and his idea of colonialism as the focus on the self. And I think we could kind of say capitalism is kind of it's similar. It's the focus on the self at the end of the day. It's you know, prizing the individual above all else. He has this, I've been reading, Ernest Becker, Escape from Evil, and Ernest Becker, extremely depressing. His theory is basically like, all we do, all of our motives is to, you know, deny the fact that we're going to die. And this goes back to the sort of trashness. Like there's an inherent trashness to human beings, where we're between worm food and a god. We're between ape and man. Becker is extremely obsessed specifically with talking about feces and the symbolism behind feces, and how it's just like that. It just always represents this ontological insecurity of like, we're an animal that's aware of the fact that we're gonna die, but we feel like we're so much more, and it's just very discouraging. And he actually talks about that it's in terms of this sort of existential shame or guilt or inherent remorse at even existing, like that we exist and there's no real like necessary reason. And he says that to kind of quell this guilt or shame, there were like rituals back in the day of like ritual sacrifice, where it's to kind of give something in return to the world or to something in order to kind of make us feel existentially better. And then, you know, throughout time and, you know, kind of skipping a lot of his argument to now talking about capitalism, we've kind of developed this, you know, perfect system of a surplus through capital, where we constantly are kind of generating more and more and more to kind of quell this remorse. And we have an entire system now of, you know, money we could just keep making more and more and more of it. And I think that's why there's so much progress, and there isn't really an end to the progress, quote unquote, of, you know, higher GDP and stuff like that. It's a system that is inherently based upon existential remorse, according to then to turn to kind of colonialism and stuff like that, his argument is a lot of our denial or fear of death results in evil, that it results in a sort of, as you said, like the idea of, in order for one thing to have inherent value, another thing has to not have that value. And he sees all of history as immortality ideologies clashing with each other. Because if my immortality ideology, which could literally just be, I'm awesome, I'm the best person, like if you're narcissistic, if it clashes with another person, you know, maybe another narcissist or something like that, you have to destroy this person on some level, because their mere existence could perhaps prove that you have every reason to feel remorse and shame for existing, because you can no longer symbolically like prove yourself. And capitalism, to then turn to Sartre, and he worked with Fanon on Wretched of the Earth. I think he did like the preface. He was quite interested in the anti-colonial project. He talks about the notion of seriality. So there's praxis, there's like we're in a shared social environment, and we're all working towards certain goals, and we leave our kind of impact on that environment. And what he notes is it is a shared social environment, but everybody is still like individualistically going for their own thing. And he calls that like seriality. And it can sometimes look like collective action. So he discusses like riots, for example. Everybody is really angry about something, but there isn't like a specific goal. Like the intentions of the group can be quite like, you know, blurry. And Sartre argues for a group praxis where there is sort of a acknowledgement of, you know, difference. There's discussion between people, but there is an overarching like goal that everybody is kind of working towards, and they're like working with each other. And there isn't that seriality. There isn't like that idea of atomized individuals all just trying to get their own. And so, and his where he embeds this argument is in his work on Marxism. So I would make the case that group praxis is inherently, you know, anti-capitalistic. And if that, you know, going back to how we're talking about the importance of other people in self-love, it does seem that like, you know, self-love could happen under capitalism, because capitalism adapts to everything, but it's also very easily corrupted, and capitalism just kind of tends to just adopt whatever is slightly antagonistic to it and makes money off of it. And I think self-love at the end of the day is inherently antagonistic to capitalism.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
That was a lot of, I don't know if that completely
makes sense. No, that's really interesting.
There's nothing to buy if you love yourself.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That's well said.
I think a big argument I have in my head a lot is when people have political conversations or economic conversations about like capitalism or communism, I almost fear equally rampant individualism at the expense of others as I do the destruction and the flattening of the individual under the collective. I think both of those things are worth fearing. Mm-hmm. And I think anyone who's into history can see examples where the individual has destroyed the collective and examples where the collective has destroyed the individual. And I think beauty can both come from the individual and the collective. So I think both things are worth protecting. But in any system, I think something that's really worth investigating is almost sadism. It's something I think about a lot, because once social bonds are destroyed for any reason, people have this deep anger and they feel very small and they feel very lonely and they want to take that out on someone else. And the reason why this world is so broken and why so many people are in need of self-love and we see these movements popping up is actually because of how much their lives have been destroyed through this kind of sadistic process of your boss's boss makes your boss feel like shit. So then your boss has to make you feel like shit. And I guess before you have a conversation about self-love, it's like, why are people so broken to begin with, you know? Capitalism is a big part of that, but also a lot of systems have led to broken people. And I think the core of what's creating all these broken people is sadism, is almost the way we pass along pain and trauma to the next person down the chain of command. And then we all try to put ourselves back together with, you know, a movement like self-love or something. But when you talk about serialism, I find that idea so interesting, because it seems like a very good combination of the individual and the collective. And I think a riot is a really good example, because when you see people rioting, maybe one person's mad because a police officer was mean to them. Another person might just be mad at the construct of private property. Another person might be mad because they don't like where their taxes are going. And they all have their own individual plight intact, but they are operating in a collective, towards a collective goal. And I think that can be the beauty of anarchy in a lot of ways. You know, you don't have to fully destroy the individual in pursuit of a collective goal. And then that can also be very, very dangerous. You know, there can be a lack of focus in that almost serialist or I guess even like anarchist approach to progress that can also be counterproductive. But yeah, I definitely find that idea very, very interesting.
No, definitely.
Yeah. Would you, throwing the question back at you, would you say that capitalism can accommodate self-love within it? Or do you think it's antagonistic to it? Or
so, not to answer your question with a question, but...
Jordan Peterson?
No, because... And then I'll answer. I just want to answer that. Do you guys believe that humans can only value something if it's scarce? Is scarcity a prerequisite for value?
Yeah, that's actually, that was the thing that that was the whole reason why I brought up the Sartre anecdote, is that this praxis that's like seriality, where people are just kind of doing their own thing, it's out of literally like a scarcity mentality. Like it's when it, I think that is when self-love could become destructive, is when there's this feeling of like there's not enough things. And especially like nowadays, it's, you can literally measure in terms of engagement, likes, like attention, you can measure how much you're kind of worth in a weird way, not actually how much you're worth, but like, you know, certain people like on Instagram, YouTube, you have like some popularity. And then there's always other people that have more, and everybody like influencers are all kind of fighting for that attention, and there's that scarcity. And it, of course that can be applied to money also. But Sartre's whole argument is that this is kind of the thing that's running the entire like operation, is the scarcity mentality. There isn't enough for everyone. So it is that kind of like, I need to get mine, which isn't really, it's once again, going back to the dichotomy, that's operating out of fear and not love. It's operating out of like, oh God, I need to do this, and not like, I want to do this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, I'm not sure why as humans, we seem to just end up in these systems that are rooted in scarcity. And I think it might just be just the human condition. Just the fact that we tend towards scarcity and just sort of emptiness, I think. I think to be human is to tend towards emptiness. And I think that's why we create these systems that sort of like are rooted in emptiness and scarcity. But I think scarcity is also just rooted in the idea that in order for me to have something, I need to take something from you. And capitalism is rooted in that idea. And I don't think love and scarcity can coexist. And in that way, I don't know that any one of us has actually experienced self-love. I think the closest you can get in the system is self-acceptance. Because I think in order for us to love ourselves, we would have to be able to like just be okay with not hoarding, like fundamentally. We would have to be okay with just like having enough. And I don't know that anyone living under capitalism has the capacity for that. And therefore, I don't know that anyone existing under capitalism has the capacity for real, genuine love. You know, I don't know. What is that, too cynical?
You know, I don't think so. I think some people, and they're never people that we would expect, almost have this profound sense of enlightenment. Like, there's this joke I love where there's this really fancy cocktail party with billionaires, and there's this waiter that goes up to a billionaire and goes, I'll have something you'll never have enough, you know? And I think that there are people that you meet just in everyday life that truly feel content with what they have. I think it comes from accepting your own mortality, because time was the initial scarce resource. Right. And I think that is why we created so many systems based on scarcity. Yeah. And it is only when you accept your mortality. I love what you said earlier, we're somewhere between worm food and a god. Yeah. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And once you accept those really, really deep human truths, and you just find peace in the fact that you're going to die, that is when you can solve for scarcity. And I don't think that humans could progress past a system like capitalism, for example, until we solve for scarcity, which is, it would mean everyone coming to grips with the fact that between about 85 and 90, we're going to drop dead, and we have to become okay with that. But something about our programming, just on an evolutionary psychological level, kind of won't let us. And that might be just a fundamental issue with who we are as animals. But I find hope in just those normal everyday people that you talk to who just seem to be pretty chill with the fact that they're going to die.
Yeah.
Pretty chill with the fact that they may never be rich. They may never be famous. And the truth, and then also almost the thing that could heal society, is almost found in like their perspective, you know? I was talking to like an elderly family member of mine the other day, and they're in their like late 80s, and they were talking about kind of being sick and some health problems they've been having, and they're like, you know, I've been here long enough. They just had such a profound acceptance of like, I've been to Egypt, I've seen it, it's any day you want to take me, it's cool. And like that's really the thing that would solve for scar. Whatever understanding of life that someone in that position, you see it in a lot of terminal cancer patients as well.
Yeah.
Just a profound acceptance of it all.
Of their mortality.
You see that in societies where people are poor in a way that they cannot transcend through hard work. You actually see it in a lot of like authoritarian societies that are very class stratified. They're like, it doesn't matter how hard I grind, I'm never going to be a billionaire, and that's okay because I have a family that I love. You know, the healing element is actually sometimes I feel right in front of us and coming from people all the time, but we don't notice it, or we'll hear someone express a deep content with death, and we'll be like, "Oh, you're suicidal," or "Oh, there's something wrong with you," or "You don't love life enough," or "You don't love yourself enough." When in reality, they might have actually figured out something that we haven't, you know?
Yeah, I think that is the paradox of scarcity, is that it's sort of the only thing that gives life meaning. And it's the only thing that makes life unbearably meaningless at the same time. Because I think, like you say, the original scarcity is time. It's the fact that we're all going to die. At the same time, it's the fact that we're all going to die that gives life meaning. It's the reason to get out of bed. There would be no reason to do anything. If someone were to commit their life to being with you, it wouldn't mean anything because they're going to be alive forever. And so I think scarcity is sort of the only real place that humans can find meaning. And that's really the paradox. But I do you think... I think what's funny about humans is that we were thrown into this world. We realized that we have this big, scarce resource, and it's time. And then we decided to build a society on top of that scarcity that's rooted in another form of scarcity. And that's what I find interesting, and what I wonder if... that's what makes me wonder if... love is possible. Not if love is possible for humans, because I do think love is possible for us. But I think it's my time living in America, living in the West as an African. My experience of America is that it's such a loveless, empty, dark society.
Tell them how you really feel.
But, you know, I'm just not convinced that individualism and love can coexist, that individualism and capitalism can coexist, because I don't think capitalism and truth can coexist. Mm. I don't think capitalism and empathy can coexist. I don't think capitalism and trust can coexist, because everyone is your op in an individualistic society. But I think we would have to dismantle capitalism in order to experience love. For those living in like really hyper capitalist societies, and I'm sure there are a lot of people in cultures that are not existing under capitalism currently.
Canada, like most Americans think Canada is like fully communist, so it's okay. We're all it's a society of love here. I think this is like a, because it's been like an hour talking, it flew by really quickly. But actually everything that you said was kind of, it's funny because I had questions, and just naturally as the discussion went on, every single question was kind of answered.
Oh, wow.
But I guess like the one last thing I'm kind of interested in to also put everything together is, at the start we talked about the idea of extending yourself for spiritual growth and trying to define that. And I think throughout this conversation, I think we have. And going back to Becker, he makes the argument with regards to why we, as you asked, like, why do we keep making systems of scarcity on top of systems of scarcity? Is his, he had an issue with how different political ideologies were trying to explain society. And so the conservative argument is, we're inherently selfish. We're inherently like, we want things for ourselves. And that when we're talking about self-love, that translates to that sort of like Sigma grind set, got to get my own like mentality. And that's kind of not really satisfying, because I do think, you know, just through behavioral economics, that's not rationally how people act. Like there is like a concern for other people. There are some people that are selfish. There are other people that aren't. It's very like, just not like the idea that humans are inherently self-interested is, you know, it is conservative dogma in some sense, and it's used to justify capitalism. On the other hand, at least his interpretation of Marxism at the time was, it completely, instead of putting the blame on natural self-interest, it puts the blame entirely on the systems and institutions, and the idea of power, and which I think, you know, makes a very good case for institutions causing a lot of these issues, and capitalism causing a lot of these issues. But it doesn't solve necessarily like why this keeps happening. And there is like the general Marxist argument of, it is through scarcity that this happens. But we have such a weird relationship with scarcity, and that has come up like in this conversation. And Becker was proposing a sort of new sort of Marxism that was united with psychology and psychoanalysis, where you don't see humans as inherently evil, and you also don't see them as like inherently like altruistic. And if we just like destroy these systems of power, we're all going to live in like a socialist utopia. He was really interested in what are we actually? And we're neither evil nor amazing. We are weak and vulnerable. That is how he saw human beings. And it's because of that like idea of death, and like we feel kind of guilty for even being here. And so we have to keep regenerating this sort of like surplus, this sort of offering or sacrifice to other people. And it's so interesting, because what you said was like, where we could find love under capitalism is these people that have accepted their death in a way that they have, like, you know, they've accepted their mortality. And I think that goes back to the idea of spiritual growth. Like, spiritual growth is so much about sort of, you feel like you're a part of something larger than yourself, but also that you feel uniquely you, like you belong to something larger, but you are also like, you're special, like you're unique. It kind of solves this, like, these two yearnings. And it doesn't necessarily have to be religious, but the idea of like, you have a finite amount of time here, but you are connected to something like larger than yourself at the same time. Yeah. So do the things that you genuinely like wish to do, which can be hard to kind of figure out, but you know, there are people out there that have figured it out. And and kind of accept the you know, finite nature of your existence. So you don't end up feeling this sort of like guilt that leads to scarcity, that leads to sort of, you know, I think self-hatred, almost like the exact opposite. But I'd love to hear your kind of your thoughts on that before we like wrap it up.
Yeah, I really agree with that. I think, spirituality is just the experience of being connected to the world around you. And I really like the Vedic idea of like spirituality, which is that we're all just a part of a whole, like, we're all just like one little puzzle piece that's part of a whole big puzzle. And I think what spiritual growth is just feeling more and more connected to the entire puzzle. And so I really think like I definitely like resonate. I really resonate with that. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
A big sort of theme to wrap us up as well that we talked about is almost this kind of inability to choose between an inability to find a balance between too much self-love and not enough self-love. How do you heal yourself while also healing your community? And then we also spoke about sadism a lot, in the sense that when people don't have community and they feel small, they make other people feel small. So the way to self-improve yourself while also improving your community would honestly be finding a way to self-soothe, so that when the world makes you feel small, you are able to heal yourself through acts of self-love or self-care without having to pass that pain and suffering onto someone else in a sadistic manner, you know? Yeah. So being able to self-soothe, back to sort of our conversation about spirituality generally, which is, I think, the positive role that spirituality plays in people's life. It could be going to church, it could be yoga, it could be all these acts of self-care. What the real positive thing, both for you and for other people, is that now that you've self-soothed, now that you've healed yourself, you don't have to continue this endless cycle of pain. You know, you don't have to sadistically make someone else feel small because you were made to feel small. And then you also feel better, you know? So you've kind of solved for both. You've done an act of self-care, and then you've also prevented further harm to other people. And now that you've self-soothed and you've improved your state of being, your outlook on the world, you can now actually be an asset to other people. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the role of spirituality, especially through a postmodernist lens where there is no objective truth.
Yeah.
The only role should be to self-soothe. What makes you feel better? Yeah. What is going to stop you from sadistically taking out your pain on other people?
What if the answer is like heroin? What if it's crack?
Well, a postmodernist would say go for it.
I think
that is the role of spirituality for maybe those of us who are a bit cynical and have a hard time sticking to one belief, or those of us who kind of are on the God is dead side and there is no objective truth. The role really should be to find a way to self-soothe.
To like, heal your trauma.
Yeah. How are you going to prevent this pain from being carried on to other people, which is inherently improving your community? And then how are you going to feel better?
Yeah.
And I think the answer to that is actually a spiritual answer.
Yeah.
And that is almost what both the conservatives and the Marxists can be a bit ignorant on sometimes. Yeah. The role of spirituality. And in sort of the myth of human progress, history is over, Francis Fukuyama worldview, like we've landed on neoliberal postmodernist capitalism and that's the best system. And we view spirituality as this archaic, really ignorant, unproductive way of organizing society. But what we've forgotten is this is how people have self-soothed for centuries.
Yeah.
And there's clearly like a very real asset in self-soothing. Mm-hmm. And that is almost the sort of glue that can keep a society together sometimes. And I think secularism has to find a way to like deal with that. And self-love might be our like primordial scream trying to recapture that, because secular society is very cold and difficult to self-soothe under. And I think maybe back to the positive definition of self-love, I think that's kind of the role that it can play.
Yeah, it's so interesting. We actually never talked about trauma because there's so much you can talk about in the context of self-love. But I think that's really, like, trauma is the elephant in the room when we think about sort of like the problems with late stage capitalism and why is everyone so alienated. And it's, yeah, it's interesting that, so many communists or politicians never take trauma into account when they're making policy or when they're like thinking about like, how can we better people's lives? And a big part of what being traumatized is being disconnected from yourself. It's just like having, it's a trauma is a severing from yourself. And I think, you know, how can we love without doing the work to reconnect?
Because being ourselves? Connected to yourself is too painful.
Right, yeah. Right. And that's what trauma is. But you can't connect with anyone until you're reconnected with yourself. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think a lot of self-love starts too from like, you know, and I think like the realm of psychology also doesn't take spirituality into account enough. It also doesn't take philosophy into account enough. But yeah, I think what is self-love without first honestly looking at your trauma and the ways that life has traumatized you and like healing that?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a... I was reading this one book. It's like the trauma of everyday life. And it's a... this psychologist, he's making the argument that like the Buddha or a lot of Buddhism comes from developmental trauma. Specifically, a lot of Buddhist scholars don't recognize the fact that when I think he was like 6 months old, his mom had passed away. And you could, his interpretation of a lot of Buddhist practice is the Buddha be kind of becoming his own maternal figure or becoming his own parent. And I mean, it is like a lot of self-soothing practices and it's not an escape from the self. I think that's a misinterpretation of Buddhism. It's, you know, some people see it as disassociation. But that's really like, that's what trauma is your brain can't handle a certain reality, so it just dissociates. And I do think like secular society, because we don't have better soothing mechanisms, there's just a lot of dissociation through, you know, entertainment or like working really hard or you know, it's very atomized interactions overall. His argument is that the Buddha actually sits with his emotions, that he fully accepts it. And he accepts these emotions through curiosity rather than fear or shame. And if there is fear or shame, he looks at those with curiosity. So there's always curiosity at the end of the day. And I think that might be kind of, at least for me, in sort of a concluding sense in terms of what I would interpret self-love as is a curiosity of the self first and foremost, to kind of, not in the sense like, I can do whatever I think I can put my mind to or something, but I don't know myself enough. I don't know like what I'm capable of yet. And you kind of remove yourself from that scarcity mentality to one of kind of just curiosity and openness. And definitely I think it lends to creativity and a desire to express yourself more.
And it's also interesting because I also think having a curiosity about yourself requires a distancing from yourself. And I also think in order to see yourself, you have to distance yourself from yourself first, because sort of what I was talking about at the very beginning, which is that spiritual growth is sort of like unearthing, getting through the rubble of like identifying with your thoughts, identifying with your emotions, identifying with your body, identifying with other people's opinions of you, just sort of like pushing all of that rubble aside and objectively witnessing yourself from a distance, I think is I think like a really crucial part of being able to love yourself.
That was an amazing conversation. And I almost feel I would be open to, in the future, to honestly further talk about this topic, because I didn't realize how much it would hit like basically every other subject in philosophy, yeah. But that was brilliant. Thank you once again for coming on, and please check out their podcast. I'll put it in the description. Thank you.
Thank you absolutely. So much.
Yeah, no, we'll have to do this again. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll have to have you on our podcast.
Absolutely.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
Yeah.